To hear even more about both this topic and other issues not being covered nearly enough by the mainstream media, you're going to want to tune in every morning to our full hour-long show. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, available on the TYT Network channel on YouTube TV. Welcome everyone to what looks like it's going to be a massive day in the news. Not only on this program, but we are in another Tuesday, which in this period of the year means primary elections, big elections coming up. And in fact, in the very close of the show, we're going to be talking about a few of those primary elections happening in Florida and in Arizona and the stakes in them. And because in both cases, we have got some of the most sycophantic, I suppose, Republicans running anywhere in the country. We're going to show you an ad that we've previously talked about on the show that Rob DeSantis, a huge Trump supporter, put out that is, I think, objectively one of the most pathetic displays politically that I've ever seen in my life, and that he's going to be running today. We're going to find out if doing effectively nothing more in your race than sucking up to Donald Trump is enough to make you, you know, one of the most high-profile Republicans in the country. We're going to have a great test of that. Similarly, in Arizona, we're going to be talking about Kelly Ward, Joe Arpaio, and Martha McSally. We were talking yesterday about Kelly Ward and her comments following the announcement by Senator John McCain that he'd be discontinuing his cancer treatment. So some amazing Republicans up. We will see if the displays they've put on actually result in electoral success for them. But there's obviously a lot of news outside of the election. So we're going to be talking about gerrymandering and a little bit of good news on that topic. We're going to be talking about some bad news when it comes to air pollution. I think that we're all pretty well aware at this point about some of the negative health repercussions of air pollution. But scientists working at Yale have discovered through the use of some Chinese data what I would say is a very unexpected outcome of rampant air pollution, which is a problem around the world. And later on, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump's new theory having to do with censorship. This time, not on social media. It has to do with Google. And he woke up and went on a tear about it. So we'll be breaking that down as well. There's lots of other stuff that we're going to get to too, but big topics to start off with, including the gerrymandering. So this year has seen in a couple of different states, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, court cases back and forth, fights against the court cases over the issue of gerrymandering. Some of these maps are incredibly manipulated, twisted into knots to produce particular political outcomes. And although it is not the case that Republicans are doing this in America, there have been cases certainly where Democrats have engaged in gerrymandering as well. In terms of the bulk of the cases and the severity of the cases, the Republicans are very much the villains in this case. And so in some of those states, you have an effectively almost split electorate, and yet almost all of the congressional seats end up going to Republicans because of their incredibly advanced gerrymandering tactics. And throughout the year, there have been a number of different court cases fighting against those and judicial rulings striking those gerrymandered maps down. In some cases, even striking them down in time for the elections in November and requiring more fair and just maps to be produced for those elections. And then inevitably there are appeals. There's news coming out of some of these states that the Republicans are looking to literally impeach the entirety of their state Supreme Court to stop these gerrymandered maps from being eliminated. Just about the worst abuse of their power I can probably imagine. But today we have yet another cycle of news on this gerrymandering in North Carolina, and at least today it is good news. So acting under an order of the U.S. Supreme Court to re-examine the case in North Carolina, a three-judge panel ruled again in favor of election advocacy groups and Democrats who had sued to challenge the boundaries drawn back in 2016. And so there had already been an earlier decision over this that was appealed. And so once again, they're saying that this map is not acceptable. And those election advocacy groups that they had talked about earlier, they had sued alleging that the GOP map makers had so manipulated the lines of the state's 13 districts that they had ensured effectively that Republicans would retain a 10-3 majority within the delegation. And just really fast, I want to put this in the context of the overall battle that we have over control of the House. So if you've been following this closely as we have, you know that the fate of the House is really coming down to just a couple of different House districts, House races that are considered within striking distance for Democrats. If the Republicans can hold them off, they retain their majority. If the Democrats have a good year, it could possibly switch. Now, in the case of North Carolina, you're talking about something like 15 to 25% of the entire needed seats to flip control of the House are effectively, if this map were to be retained, simply taken away through gerrymandering. It's not that the Republicans are popular in that state. It's not that the 10-3 majority that they have is representative of a lot of goodwill towards Republicans there. It's that the districts have just been manipulated, twisted. And so this could actually, assuming it's done in time for the November election, could actually be very significant, not just for North Carolina, but for the entirety of the country. And in fact, the Greensboro-based court that ruled today raised the possibility of directing the GOP-dominated legislature to redraw the maps by mid-September so that they could be in effect for the fall elections, or of getting an outside expert to do so. The printing of ballots in North Carolina has already been delayed while other fall election matters are in court. And so that's a possibility, but we definitely don't know at this point. And I would say that in particular, in this case, where you have Republicans controlling the state legislature, there is going to be any number of different opportunities that they have to slow this process down. If they take control of the process, that will be a constant throughout. And it seems unlikely from where I'm sitting that this will actually be enforced by the November election. The time it takes to both produce a new map, have it tested to make sure that it's not biased in a similar fashion as the established map, possibly have court cases resolved based on the new map. I mean, all of that you're talking about, that could be a months long process. And we have something like 69 days until the election, give or take a day or two. And so that seems difficult. If on the other hand, they do decide to hire an outside expert, which under normal circumstances, I'm in favor of. I prefer some sort of independent body, a nonpartisan body. We've seen that used successfully in some states, I believe including Arizona at this point. That seems like a better option, but even the process of hiring that expert could be time consuming. And if it's the Republicans are doing the search committee for that, if they're authorizing, you know, the person who will end up being chosen, that could be delayed by months as well. And so in the wake of this news, I think there's been a lot of excitement online about the possibility that, oh my God, this could be in effect for November. This could put the Democrats over the finish line. I think that it's unlikely at this point that that's actually going to happen. But I will say that the judges who ruled today, who had previously ruled, did have some good quotes about the future of gerrymandering in this country. And in particular, I want to highlight a quote from U.S. Circuit Judge Jim Wynn, who said, "The U.S. Constitution does not allow elected officials to enact laws that distort the marketplace of political ideas so as to intentionally favor certain political beliefs, parties, or candidates and disfavor others." So I like that sentiment. I certainly do. And I wish that the Constitution was interpreted in multiple different areas of our democracy to ensure that that is the outcome. But that's not so much the case. I mean, look, we have gerrymandering at the state level. We have things like North Carolina. Obviously, if you look throughout the country, there is a significant amount of gerrymandering. I mean, we've talked previously about Texas in particular. And there, in some cases, gerrymandering has been used in a way that favors individual Democrats. And around Houston, actually, that is the case in Texas. But again, in general, Texas is a great case where you're talking about one or possibly more seats that justifiably should be given to the other party. So it's great for, you know, U.S. Circuit Judge Jim Wynn to say that, but he doesn't have authority. His court doesn't have authority over the entirety of the country. And there are certainly circuit courts that don't care at all about this or implicitly favor this sort of gerrymandering, either to manipulate racial demographics or to favor one party, you know, over another. And then obviously, in terms of the manipulations of the system to produce some sort of particular political outcome, gerrymandering, thankfully, is one of the most high profile instances of that. And it's something that, at least over the past few years, we have seen more people talk about. But the system is manipulated in any number of different ways to produce these outcomes. I mean, obviously, we focus here at TYT on the issue of money in politics, and that is an amazing way to manipulate the system in a thousand ways that are much more difficult to identify particular cases of than something like gerrymandering, where you can put up a picture and you see the districts and they look like some sort of ridiculous cartoon. It's easy to point to that and say that's obviously unjust. But when it's the effect of lobbyists and connections between people who've once been in government to those that are still there, donations and things like that, it's harder for a lot of people to draw those lines very clearly. Then you have things like, obviously, the Electoral College. Remember, we were talking about that after the election, and we were told you're not supposed to try to make any sort of big change like that immediately after a contentious election. Well, now we're more than a year out, nobody's talking about it anymore. But certainly the Electoral College, just in the past 20 years, has manipulated the outcome that we have to produce a particular political outcome multiple times. And so all of these sorts of concerns need to be front and center, not just during an election like this, but going forward. We have a great result here in North Carolina on gerrymandering, but way more work to do, not just in an individual state, but across the entirety of the country.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, I really want you to stick around for the information coming out of Yale and China on air pollution, because we're all affected by this, and it has some effects that I don't think anyone watching this program was aware of. After this. Welcome back, everyone. John Iadarola running solo today. And in this block, we've got a couple of different environmental stories. Now, the bulk of this block is unfortunately going to be negative. Some of the information that we're going to be covering about air pollution is, I would say, scary to say the least. But I want to start off with a little bit of good news. This is a small thing that I happen to notice today, reported by the Chicago Tribune. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, so obviously one of the Libby courts, has ordered the ban of a top-selling pesticide. This is chlorpyrifos. Now, chlorpyrifos is a very common pesticide. It's sprayed in fruits and vegetables and all of that sort of stuff. It is bad, though. It causes developmental problems, brain problems, and things like that, especially in the young when it's consumed. And when it was used as widely as it was, that's a massive problem. Now, it had previously already been banned under the Obama administration. But last year, the EPA said, you know what? That's okay. We're going to lift the ban and allow people to purchase this. They didn't care about the studies linking it to negative health outcomes. It's a popular, relatively cheap, and widely used product, and they care about what the industry wants, and so they allowed it. Now, thankfully, in this case, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals took up the case again, said that the EPA violated the law and did not due credence to scientific studies showing these health outcomes. And so within 60 days of this court decision, assuming it's not appealed again, I suppose, to the Supreme Court, although this seems like an odd thing for them to rule on, it will have to be banned for sale inside of the United States. So that is certainly good news. And really fast, a reminder of how significant who you have in the White House is. I mean, this is the sort of issue that, again, I know we say this all the time, I apologize, this is not going to get covered a lot. I doubt when the ban was lifted last year that it was covered very often. But there are going to be kids throughout the country who, if these chlorpyrifos, if it was still used, their lives are going to be irreparably changed. And why? Because you have an EPA that is no longer working to actually protect people from various environmental pollutants, toxins, and things like that. Instead, the EPA is just another, it's another lobbying group. It's a trade group. It works for the benefit of polluters now. And the reason for that is not that anything fundamental inside of the EPA has changed. It's that the leadership was changed. It was changed by Donald Trump. He put in a group of incredibly corrupt pro-corporate interests. And these are the sorts of outcomes that you get. And some of them, thankfully, make big news. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Scott Pruitt and how corrupt he was. But in terms of the actual policies that he changed, I would say that that was maybe 20% or less of all of the coverage. And now we have an amazing task ahead of us to reverse some of the damage that he was able to do inside of the EPA and the damage that will still be done even once Scott Pruitt is gone. Not to mention, of course, the opportunity cost of having had some sort of responsible stewardship of the EPA for over a year. That could have been great, especially as a country faces a number of massive challenges, not least of which is climate change, but also issues like air pollution, which I'll turn to now. So I want to talk about a new study. This was conducted by the Yale School of Public Health. It found that high pollution levels led to significant drops in test scores in language and arithmetic, with the average impact equivalent to having lost a year of the person's education. Now, I will admit that when you hear a graphic like that, you think, what could that possibly, how could air pollution actually cause that? And how do you even test for that? Well, this is a really interesting study because, in effect, there was a China Family Panel Studies. It's a group of ongoing large-scale tests inside of China that has access to, like literally in this case, 20,000 people. And what they did was they looked at a number of different tests that were done across this massive population between 2010 and 2014. And they tested them in various language and arithmetic tests. And then they mapped the information based on where those people lived to various forms of pollution registered over time. And I'm sure you're aware that China is an area that has particularly horrendous pollution problems. But it's not limited just to China. Something like 95% of the population breathes in air on a daily basis that is considered in one or multiple ways to be unhealthy. The problem might not be quite as bad as it is in China, but in major cities around the world, it is effectively as bad, at least in parts of the year. And so in this case, imagine for tens of thousands or hundreds or possibly millions of people to have effectively lost 1 year of education. I have no clue how we would even quantify the long-term impact of that, not just on the quality of a person's life, but like if we're just looking in hard economic terms, what is it like for a population to lose a year of schooling without even knowing about it? And especially to do so because of something like air pollution that we would typically think of air pollution causing respiratory illnesses and things like that. And we know that that's incredibly dangerous. Actually, air pollution has been said to cause 7 million premature deaths every single year. Which, if you haven't heard that stat before, and I believe we've cited it before, that should blow your mind. How many other things can we trace 7 million premature deaths a year to? And yet, although every person in the world knows that air pollution is bad, does anyone think that it's as big of a killer as it actually is? What percentage of our conversation politically goes to air pollution? What percentage of our science-specific conversation goes to air pollution? 3 to 5%, maybe? Isn't air pollution something that we had to deal with in LA back in like the 80s and 90s? Haven't we tackled that thing? No, we have not. We haven't done it in major parts of the world, developing places like India and China, but also inside of the United States. And let's keep it real for a minute. One of the reasons we don't talk much about pollution in this country is because, as in so many other areas, environmental justice is the pollution is not just widely distributed evenly across the entire population. It's not like I'm being affected and then the Koch brothers get a respiratory tract infection. That's not the way that it goes. If you're poor and thus less likely to have the natural focus of the mainstream media in the first place, you're more likely to suffer from air pollution. Now, so this is something that I pay attention to, and I was actually lucky enough that in my personal life, my girlfriend has worked with nonprofits that do green space development in economically less advantaged areas. And one of the things that they focus on in terms of trying to educate the populations that they go into inside of LA is that in particular, these communities, which tend to be clustered around highways, like we think about that there is smog in LA, there's air pollution in LA, but it can be concentrated quite locally around these major areas of congestion. And it's all the more important that we get green spaces there to help to absorb some of this. But while that's true on a very concentrated area, the cities themselves have far more air pollution. And it's easy for a lot of people, especially politicians at the national level, media at the national level, to write that off. Sure, many of them might live in DC, they might live in New York, but how often are they thinking the plight of people who live in areas that have far higher concentrations of air pollution? Probably not so much. And so here's the thing. This information from China, incredibly interesting because it opens the discussion into an area that previously we had not been focusing on. But let's not forget the more traditional problems with air pollution. Recent studies have linked toxic air to extremely high mortality in people with mental disorders, and earlier work linked it to increased mental illness in children, while another analysis found that those living near busy roads had an increased risk of dementia. And these problems are, as in so many other areas is the case, particularly a problem for the young and for the elderly. And in fact, if we could go back to the China thing, while this causes problems with arithmetic and language skills across the entire population, in this particular case, the effect for seniors was by far the worst. And this is a community that, as you know, already has to deal with these sorts of issues just naturally, things like increased risk of Alzheimer's, dementia, all of that. But if they're living in big cities, they might be suffering from greater cognitive decline without any idea of what's actually causing it. Now, I want to thank, in this case, The Guardian did a great write-up on this. I'm hoping that a lot of people will read it. But this is the sort of problem that we can't solve at the local level necessarily. We can't even solve it at the national level. This requires international cooperation. And we live in a period in American history where our country has no interest in those sorts of pacts. We already pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. How are we going to get something international to deal with air pollution? Especially when the businesses, the corporations that are producing that, they have their men in the White House. They have their men in Congress right now. Okay, obviously serious problem. More that we're going to get to. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to turn to issues of labor rights. And one of Donald Trump's pervasive, areas of focus in terms of his executive orders has been limiting the rights of unions, their ability to fundraise and things like that. We actually have a little bit of good news on that. And I believe in this next block, we'll also be able to get to today's obsession for Donald Trump. And that is how Google is apparently manipulating the news to convince you that things aren't going well for him. We'll break down the evidence for that after this. Welcome back, everyone. Let's turn to a little bit of good news. So there has been an ongoing campaign by Republicans for 75 years to destroy unions. And with Donald Trump in the White House, they had a few really quick successes. And so that came in the area of executive orders, where he was trying to limit, particularly in the area of federal employees, their abilities to collectively bargain and things like that. Well, as of today, a judge has struck down several of those executive orders. Let's talk about what those were meant to accomplish. Three of those executive orders, which were signed in May, made it easier for managers to fire underperforming federal employees, limited the amount of official work time in which unions could weigh grievances, and ordered the renegotiation of collective bargaining agreements. So the first area, let's talk about that. Donald Trump, for a long time, has apparently been incredibly frustrated by his inability to unilaterally fire anybody in federal government that he wants to. And that's something that aides have often talked about, generally not on the record, but he gets so angry that he doesn't have the sort of control that he had on NBC over everyone working around him. And so it's entirely possible that while that is cloaked in the guise of being about just making sure that people are doing their jobs, it's about weakening the standards in terms of what it takes to actually fire these employees, which I would consider a bit of a slippery slope at this point. The second one involves how much of the time on the job the unions can actually exercise to sort of accomplish their goals, attempting to rein them in wherever possible. And in the third case, renegotiation of collective bargaining agreements, because they are viscerally opposed to the very concept of collective bargaining. Now, as an outsider, I think I know why Trump went about this in this particular way, because there are a lot of unions in various areas, but I would consider that even people who are involved in other unions probably see federal government employees as a sort of special class of worker that I don't think it's any exaggeration to say politicians have spent literally decades trying to make them out to be the laziest, most entitled workers in the country. And so it might be a little bit safer that if you're going to attempt to set some sort of precedent of weakening unions, you do that in the case of federal government employees, who very few people have sort of negative positive connotations towards. But we also know where this is intended to go. This is part of a concerted effort by the Labor Department, Donald Trump, Republicans at the state level, to destroy the sources of funding and the ability to collectively bargaining of unions, because that obviously benefits the employers. So in this case, federal judge striking it down, certainly good news, although I wouldn't take it too far. I wouldn't get too excited about this. The war continues on multiple levels. But we've got Donald Trump up there. Why don't we turn to Donald Trump's morning escapades? And they took place on Twitter. So early today, he tweeted this. Google search results for Trump news, shows only the viewing reporting of fake new media. In other words, they have it rigged for me and others so that almost all stories and news is bad. Fake CNN is prominent. Republican conservatives and fair media is shut out. Illegal. 96% of results on Trump news are from national left-wing media. Very dangerous. Google and others are suppressing voices of conservatives and hiding information of news that is good. They're controlling what we can and cannot see. This is a very serious situation. Will be addressed. So there are some issues with that. First of all, very tiny note. I don't know why this happened, but Donald Trump tweeted that out early this morning. And then 4 hours later, he tweeted the exact same two tweets. And then he deleted the earlier ones. I could not see any differences between them, so I don't know what that was about. Maybe he just wanted more retweets, but a little bit odd there. And then, what is this about? Because we know Google has put out a statement saying that search is not used to set a political agenda, and we haven't seen any evidence that in the particular area of Trump news that they're manipulating search results to produce some sort of outcome. So what is actually leading to Donald Trump going on this tirade? Well, there's two theories at this point. The first is that on Fox, recently there was an interview with Diamond and Silk where they go on to again say that they're being censored on various online sites, social media, Google, things like that. It is irrelevant at this point that multiple independent analyses show that they are not being censored on these sites, not on Facebook, not on Twitter, anything like that. In fact, they seem to be doing quite well historically in comparison to other media outlets. But that doesn't matter. Fox News is a network of white and conservative grievance, and so that's the message that they're going to send. So Diamond and Silk can be debunked any number of times. They're going to keep spreading their message. So it could be that. Or it could be that recently, Paula Bolyard, who's the supervising editor for PJ Media and self-described cultural nonconformist, wrote an article saying that she searched Trump on Google News and weighed the results using a media bias chart developed by Cheryl Atkinson, former CBS News correspondent. Bolyard said left-leaning outlets accounted for 96% of the results, with CNN stories making up nearly 29% of the total. She did, however, acknowledge that her methods are not scientific. But why don't we just pretend that they are and have the president of the United States, the most powerful person in the world, simply assert that they are the case? And you'll note, of course, that he used the actual number from her article. So it seems incredibly likely that that information was spread to him, although I find it hard to believe that he actually read it himself. So here are some problems with the president's theory. In terms of when you search for Trump news, does that give you good or bad news? Does it give you an accurate representation of what the news is like in this country? First of all, he seems to believe that Trump news, if you search for that, and if it was fair, that would tell you what's going on in this country. That's not the case at all. Trump news will give you news about Donald Trump. And I've got Trump news for you. The news has been bad for Trump recently. I don't know if maybe he's not aware of this, but his personal lawyer and his former campaign chairman just pled guilty to 16 different election-related counts in terms of money laundering and wire fraud and all sorts of other fraud and all of that. If he believes that the news is going to be positive towards him in the wake of that, he must be watching a lot of Fox News, because that's not the case. Also, those results that you get when you search for something on Google, they are going to be manipulated to some extent. But they're manipulated by the fact that some outlets put out far more total news. CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, those produce more articles than dozens and dozens of blogs do on a daily basis. And so if you rate some of those outlets like CNN as left-leaning, which I think is a joke, if you count all of that as left, yeah, it's going to look like a lot of the news that's coming out is left. I would ask a leftist about whether the news is left when it's coming out from CNN. But more importantly, I apologize. I'm wasting your time by dignifying this with a serious response. The reason Donald Trump is saying this is not that he thinks that Google is actually manipulating the results. He is just advancing conspiracy theories that are very popular on the right now, that every media outlet that exists is in a conspiracy against them, that they're systematically being censored, their views are being manipulated. They're far more popular than they appear to be, the shadow bans and all of that. This is just another step in that. And where it gets dangerous, and the reason that it actually makes it onto the show today, is that Donald Trump says that they might have to look into this. And in fact, within hours of his announcement, his chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, came out and said that they will be looking into the possibility that Google search results need to be regulated. What does that mean? God only knows. But I could guess. I could guess what sorts of changes they might want. We've seen, by the way, when Facebook says that they're going to do more to fix fake news. What do they end up doing? They bring on Fox to produce a lot of content for them. They have a board looking into bias in terms of media presentation on Facebook that does not have one liberal body on it. All conservatives and those who would define themselves as centrists. That's what balance looks like to them. Now, would Google actually accede to this? I don't think so. Is this actually going to happen? Probably not. But if you are interested in censorship online and you've been distracted by the BS arguments of people like Alex Jones, here's the real censorship coming. And Donald Trump's very clear in those original tweets about what his what the outcome he is looking for would actually be. Again, I think that it's unlikely that this would actually come, but certainly not impossible at this point. Okay, we're going to take a bit of an early break because I want to give time to our interview guest who's coming on in just a little bit. So we have a candidate for Broward County County Commissioner. He's going to be coming on to talk about some of the problems going on in his race. Now, this is a topic we come back to a lot. Manipulations of who gets to be involved in these primaries, people putting pressure to vote for one candidate or another. We're going to be talking about what's actually going on in that race and what some of the stakes might be after this. Welcome back, everyone. So through this season of primaries, there have been a number of different issues that have cropped up. Issues in terms of parties getting involved where they shouldn't be. Issues in terms of the actual vote being counted in some cases. But we've got a case of some of the most interesting issues cropping up really in the week in advance of the election that I've seen before. And we're joined by one of the candidates in this race to discuss it. This is a Broward Commission candidate, Ryan Ross. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So I want you to help us walk through this issue. So you have asked the court to move the election that is taking place today to November because of issues in terms of who was allowed to be involved in the election, which actually changes who can vote in the election. But it looks like the election is going to continue to take place today. So what was that process like? What do you think might actually happen if you're successful?
We're pretty confident that the courts will rule in our favor that this fake write-in candidate is only in this race as a means to disenfranchise 50% of the electorate in our district. Unfortunately, this is how the election laws have been used by elected officials in the state of Florida. And we have a unique case here where there have been a number of attempts previously to have write-ins dismissed. But because of the way that the law is written and the way the courts have upheld it, it's been very difficult. So we have a unique case where the write-in candidate actually perjured himself, or so we think, by indicating that he is a member of the write-in party and not a member of whichever party he's affiliated with, in this case, the Democratic Party.
So so you've alluded to this candidate. So who is this quote-unquote write-in party candidate? And how is this changing who is allowed to vote in your election?
The name of the candidate is Antoine Levette, and I've had a number of conversations with him. I've called and asked specifically for him to withdraw from the race. He has attended no functions. He's raised no money. He's campaigned at no events. He's established no social media presence. This is not uncommon, but unfortunately, the way it works is in South Florida, at least, where Democrats have a really strong hold on government, is an elected official will use a write-in candidate to then disallow all non-Democrats from participating in that election where there is not a general election. So our election today, where they're voting right now, closes at 7, would be the end of it if everyone was allowed to vote. But because of the write-in candidate, unfortunately, it closes it to only Democrats. And then in this case, 50% of the electorate, which is Republicans, independents, and others, will not get to participate. And then the write-in candidate withdraws from the race about a day after the primary. So there is no general election. And the winner of this primary becomes the winner of the race itself.
Well, that is, I think, to everyone watching this, that's objectively a very bizarre outcome that we have here. Is it your view that this is the reason that this is allowed to continue is that it generally is I guess, done to take votes away potentially from, you know, a candidate like you who's progressive, who's not, you know, one of the established candidates? Because in this case, obviously, there is another establishment candidate there. Is this intentionally allowed to produce that sort of outcome?
Absolutely. The purpose of this loophole, or at least as elected officials use it, is designed to protect incumbency and to protect the establishment elected official. In this race, there's only my opponent, who is one of the highest elected officials in Broward County, and myself. And but for this write-in candidate, all voters would have been eligible to vote. But regrettably, they use this loophole to ensure that only pockets of the electorate get to participate in an election. So our action is less about, you know, a means to win this election. For me, it's just about protecting and safeguarding the, you know, democratic process that we have here. And regrettably, whether it's Republicans and independents being disenfranchised in South Florida, or, you know, Democrats being disenfranchised in North Florida, independents across Florida don't get to participate in the highest elected offices in their county. And we find this to be a despicable practice. We've been calling attention to it for 2 years. We knew it would come. And we were just grateful to have an opportunity to challenge this in the courts, because we think that this raises the awareness of really how bad our election laws are in Florida. You know, I understand people have what they believe to be legitimate concerns about the open primary question, but voters have decided this question in 1998 in Florida, and it's only been through the use of state advisory opinions and the courts that elected officials have been able to circumvent the will of the voters, who have said, if it's only a primary, we want everybody participating because there is no general. And so this is really just a disastrous way to run an election and to encourage voter participation. You know, we keep saying in our race, you know, whether we lose by a landslide or win by a vote, we're going to continue this court case despite the results of tonight. So if I win tonight against probably all better judgment, you know, where I could just accept that win and not risk losing in November, we're going to keep fighting because we want to make sure we say to every voter, your voice matters and your vote counts regardless of party affiliation.
You know, I'm glad especially that you brought this up, because earlier in the program, we were talking about the North Carolina gerrymandering decision that came out this weekend. And in that decision, we read a quote from U.S. Circuit Judge Jim Wynn that said, the U.S. Constitution does not allow elected officials to enact laws that distort the marketplace of political ideas so as to intentionally favor certain political beliefs, parties, or candidates. And here you have a great example of one that, absent your lawsuit, would probably fly under the radar for the vast majority of voters and effectively amounts to perfectly legal voter suppression.
Absolutely. That is exactly what this is about. I mean, this is a means to suppress the vote and disenfranchise voters. Yeah. I mean, what we need to do is really look hard at these laws and start to elect legislators who care about the types of things we're doing in our elections. I mean, we have independents who are outpacing both Republicans and Democrats in their registrations. And if we have laws specifically designed to exclude them from the vote, and obviously in this case, it's Republicans as well and other minor party affiliations, you know, we would have a situation or a system that really, you know, is probably one of the most unfair, unjust election processes in a democratic country.
Yeah. So, look, obviously the court case, extremely interesting, and we're going to want to see how it plays out regardless of whether you win today or not. But you're a candidate for office, and so I want to ask you, we have a bit of an idea, I think, at this point of what a strong progressive represents potentially in Congress or even in the White House. At the county commission level, what can a strong progressive accomplish? What would your goal be in office?
We're really running on values here, and we want to give voters a reason to vote. So we sort of said, we're going to concern ourselves with justice and charity and apply those to every issue. So we have a for-profit prison in my district. We have, you know, homelessness and affordable housing crisis that has really gotten out of hand, and it has been ignored for too long with such small efforts being done at both the municipal level and the county level. So one of the things we want to do is go ahead and say, we're going to fight with our legislators to make sure that there's pressure on them to close these for-profit prisons. And another big area is we're going to look at education. My background's in education, And so I've kind of said the county commissioners are making $100,000 salaries. They're working less than 20 meetings a year, and they don't work in the summers. This is a part-time job, 5 hours a month in a regular meeting. And so I'm donating 50% of my commissioner's salary, which amounts to about $50,000 every year, to secure tuition-free college and trade school for every student that comes out of Broward County. And we think that's going to be sort of we hope that that's going to be something that really kind of sets the example and the pace for the rest of Florida to get behind this issue of supporting our young people and saying, we want to make sure you have an economic future. And when you enter into high school, you're going to know that there's trade school or there's college waiting for you. And you're not going to have crippling education debt that carries with you all throughout your life.
Well, Broward Commission candidate Ryan Ross, thank you for joining the show. Obviously, good luck in your ongoing legal battle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, one little reminder I want to give you in advance of today's primaries. It's going to come in video form. You're not going to want to miss it. We'll see you after this. And we return with the most important news of the day. Today is Shania Twain's birthday. Happy birthday, Shania. And now to the primaries. So in Florida and Arizona, we're going to have two tests of the principle that to get elected as a Republican in 2018, you need one characteristic. That is loving the president more than anyone has ever loved a man or a woman before. And that has generally been a successful electoral strategy throughout these primaries, although not universally. And so today, we have two of perhaps the most ridiculous examples of it. The first is Ron DeSantis is a congressman. He's running in the Republican primary for Florida governor against State Agricultural Commissioner Adam Putnam, who I'm sure is just a delightful fellow himself. But I want to focus on Ron DeSantis because he really, really wanted Trump's endorsement. He asked him for it, and in the end, he got it. And one of the ways that he got it was with one of the most fawning, deferential, brown-nosing political ad that has ever been produced, let alone released. Here it is.
Everyone knows my husband, Ron DeSantis, is endorsed by President Trump, but he's also an amazing dad. Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
He's teaching Madison to talk.
Make America great again.
People say Ron's all Trump, but he is so much more.
Big league. So good.
That last shot in particular is just him saying Trump catchphrases. It has nothing to do with what the kid is actually doing. He didn't even say baby. At least that would have been applicable. There's a baby there. They weren't like at a baseball game. What's with the big league? Anyway, so look, Ron DeSantis thinks that making a public mockery of himself and saying, there's nothing you need to know about me except that I love Donald Trump more than any of the other candidates, and that that might get him elected. And he might be right about that, actually, because Adam Putnam, who probably also is quite, you know, deferential to the president, would support his policies, all of that, has not produced an ad quite that embarrassing. And so Ron DeSantis, this is one of the elections tonight that you're going to want to be watching for, because I honestly can't tell you what other qualification he has to be the governor. He's a congressman, I guess. There he is. He's teaching his child to build walls to keep immigrants out. I don't want to go too far, and I don't want to say something crazy, but seeing this conservative white man teach his little white child to bar the gates from immigrants is not an image we need in sort of mainstream political advertising. I will just say that. So just keep a note on that election. But I want to turn to one other, because in the Arizona Senate Republican primary, we also have an example of the DeSantis principle. And there you have Representative Martha McSally, the first woman combat pilot in American history, who didn't like Trump during the primary in 2016, but she's since turned to loving him, as all Republicans have. She looks like she's probably going to win, at least at this point. But she's also running against Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is an objectionable person in his own right. But as of this morning, I saw Casey Hunt tweet out a conversation he had where he said this. Casey Hunt asked him, "Do you think John McCain is a patriot?" Arpaio says yes. Casey Hunt says, "A hero?" Arpaio says, "That's hard for me to answer because I never had a hero in my life until several months ago when I woke up after 75 years and I found my hero. You know who that person is? Donald Trump." Now look, If you're a progressive, if you're a lib, if you're a centrist watching this, that probably makes you feel kind of sick, like deep in your stomach. If you're a Republican, there is still like a 75% chance that you find that to be endearing. But I want you to buckle up, because in a few years, you're going to look back on this time. And I don't know if he's going to have left office peacefully, been forced out of office, if he's in a federal penitentiary. But the idea that this sort of deference would be a necessity for elected office is going to be a joke, even inside of the Republican Party. I guarantee it. Okay, election coverage coming up tonight. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow morning with more. To hear even more about both this topic and other issues not being covered nearly enough by the mainstream media, you're going to want to tune in every morning to our full hour-long show. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, available on the TYT Network channel on YouTube TV.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.